emit anything significant.
What other particulates might be generated from the site?
Well, the passage of wind over the ballast, surprisingly perhaps, will actually generate possibly more dust than particulate if you want to
Differentiate between the two,
differentiate
yeah.
between them. But that is something that's often not given due accord. So keeping your ballast clean, so to speak, is important. So, I would have the ballast washed down. That's what I would do. Or clean ballast going in the first place. You can't be absolutely certain it's going to be, of course, but angular ballast is fairly free of particulate.
Think my next question's Artemis Bell, so I'll just add those
Okay.
to my list for her. Thank you very much.
That's okay.
Good afternoon, Dr. Havelt. Just, we're 8 minutes into the PM. I do have a couple of questions, and some are a matter of clarification. So I think that paragraphs 4.16 to 4.18 of your evidence, you're talking about mitigation options and how to make sure that there is an awareness of how much dust is being created and what the appropriate action should be. Just for clarity for myself, are you recommending that there should be a combination of dust deposition monitoring and monitoring of total suspended particulates?
I would recommend both. Yes, the deposited is the cruder method, and it's off, sometimes referred to as the rain gauge method because that's effectively what it is. It's a often a perspex conical shape into which and with water in it to which the dust falls, and it's got a certain surface area at the top of it. It's a fairly inaccurate monitoring method, but it does have utility, and you can get out and put those monitors out now, within reason. And you might, for the expense involved, you might dot the site with them around the perimeter anyway.
And also at point 4.18, you're stepping through a sort of qualitative risk assessment to identify how risky the development could be. And I guess my question is, where would you put the hub in terms of this risk rating?
It's high risk. That is a rule of thumb guide, and obviously fairly qualitative, but it's useful, I think. And it takes into account the area of the site and how close the sensitive receptors are, and things like truck movements and so on as well. And they're all factors in generating and emitting dust.
It's certainly helpful for me to help understand your overall view. Paragraph 5.7 and 5.8, you're talking about using existing boreholes on site as a way to monitor potential groundwater contamination. And my understanding is you're talking about doing that through the construction process. What would you see happening with those boreholes during the operational
They'd
phase?
be sealed.
So you wouldn't
No,
need them for continued monitoring?
no. No, I think that suggestion too relies on where we may find contamination when we do our detailed site investigation, because bores closest to those locations, if there are any of contamination, will be obviously where you want to monitor your groundwater down gradient of any contamination that you're concerned about. So it could be end up being a rather selective process, and we don't quite know which bores we'll need, and we may not need any.
Thank you. I think that was my last question.
Thank you, Dr. Hidalgo. It's been very helpful and appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir. Next witness to call is John McKenzie, lighting expert.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
I've prepared a summary of my key conclusions. If I could just start with that and address anything else thereafter.
Thank you.
Kiwi Rail have prepared a concept design for the freight hub, which outlines its key components and their locations. A lighting report was prepared by Stantec based on that concept design and lodged with the notice of requirement. I peer reviewed the lighting report with respect to effects, and I recommended a range of improvements to minimise lighting effects. This resulted in the updated lighting report, which is attached to my evidence at Appendix 1. Based on the updated lighting report, I'm of the opinion that the lighting effects will be suitably addressed as the calculated values comply with ASNZS 4282-2019, which is the control of obtrusive effects of outdoor lighting, the Zone A2, recommended limits for spill light, glare and sky glow. On that basis, in my opinion, the lighting effects will be low to negligible, i.e. less than minor. This lighting standard has been developed over more than 20 years and represents best practice for the control of obtrusive light effects in New Zealand. It provides different target performance levels for different environments. The surrounding environment of the freight hub is semi-rural, which is classified in the standard as Zone A2. The updated lighting report achieves best practice target performance for this environment. The panel had requested the height measurements for the lights at the existing freight yard, Tremaine Avenue. These are 36.5 metres high and mounted on lattice work tower structures. The freight hub lights, by comparison, will be shorter, with the tallest at 20 metres high and mounted on thinner columns. Figures 2 to 7 of my evidence, pages 7 to 10, contain indicative images of lighting that would be similar to that expected at the freight hub. The Section 42A report was prepared on the basis of the earlier lighting design. Since preparation of the Section 42A report, the Council's lighting expert, Mr. Wright, and myself have discussed the updated lighting design. We prepared a joint witness statement that confirms that we are broadly in agreement on technical matters and that the updated lighting design will achieve the relevant lighting standards.
I'm learning to read panel. Do you have that, JWS?
No, we do not, and it would be very, very helpful if we did.
Yes, we'll... I don't think it's Cass' fault. We'll get that to you. I wonder, matters are agreed on technical matters. Mr. McKenzie will keep trucking on that, if that's all right, but we'll certainly ensure you have that.
Yeah, at worst, it's about a 2 or 3 page document. I can at least read it to you. So just in conclusion of my summary, in terms of the most recent lighting conditions, i.e. those recommended by the Council, I am generally comfortable with these conditions, subject to a number of minor points that will be addressed by Ms. Bell.
Commissioner Makinson, who always puts us to shame in getting to the detail, shows us up as well. That's all right.
I've got the email here with the attachment. I'm just email it through to you directly.
Thanks.
Well, that's that brings me to the conclusion of my summary. So I'll just, if you'd like to know what the nature of those small amendments are for the conditions. One was suggesting we add in, as the panel suggested, so it'd be 75A effectively, a new condition.
Page number.
So, yep. So I've suggested that we add a new clause, say 75A, which calls for a suitably qualified and experienced person to undertake the lighting design.
This is after 75 or 75A? After 75,
yep. And the only other one of significance was condition, Council's condition 76A, which relates to, which is a non-lighting condition, it's actually related to reflectance of buildings. I suggest that be moved out of the operational lighting design plan, perhaps into section 57A, I think, landscape and design. Otherwise, I'm happy with the conditions that Council have proposed.
Thank you.
And I'm happy to answer any questions. Yes.
Thank you. I'll just ask my commissioners. Just one question from me. You very helpfully in your evidence did effectively a further iteration of the lighting proposal to demonstrate significant improvement in the emissions from the site. The conditions now refer to various standards as opposed to this particular solutions. Are you comfortable that those conditions effectively deliver those types of solutions?
Yes, I am. I mean, solutions were proof of concept that it was practical to achieve compliance with those standards, which were the benchmark in the first place. So basically, by conditioning that we want compliance with those standards collectively, we are effectively saying we want what's in the updated lighting design plan or better.
Thank you. All right, well, if there are any questions arising from the joint witness statement, we'll come back to you. But other than that, we appreciate your time and thank you for your statement of evidence, which I read with interest.
Lovely. Thank you.
So,
thank you, sir. We'll call Dr. Childs.
Welcome, Dr. Childs.
Nice. Water.
Now, Dr. Childs, as we said yesterday, please treat us gently and walk us through this. We've got a lot of material and acoustic evidence is dense even at the best of times. So,
find a way of putting it, sir. If you need any plans, just ask me.
What can we do? Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I will just wait till your counsel comes back. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Pre-dinner entertainment. So as you just suggested, I thought I'd start off just by talking through the drawings, just to provide a degree of orientation for the assessment before getting into my summary of evidence in more detail.
Just make sure you speak into that microphone and speak up, please.
Certainly. Given the orientation, I'll focus very much on the operational noise effects, which I think are the key issue, and they're certainly where there's not that many points of difference between myself and Mr. Lloyd, but they mainly relate to the operational noise, so I'll focus on that. More than happy to talk about the other aspects of construction and so forth, but I'll start off on the operational noise. So looking at the site plan that's on the screen, we're looking at a two-dimensional plan here. It's very important from a noise point of view to understand the topography of the area, and you would have seen this yourselves, but just in terms of how it affects the noise, it's important to keep in mind the land on this is generally sloping east to west, or on this drawing top to bottom, such that it's the houses that I'm most interested in, the receivers where the noise effects occur, such that quite a few of the houses to the east of the site are higher than the site, and the ones to the west and the south are generally lower than the site. So that's a relevance when we come to talk about noise barriers. And again, at the north, the houses on Maple Street, they're elevated some 5 metres higher than the site. And within that general pattern, the topography is quite variable, undulating. So there's not a consistent issue there, particularly on the east. I think Mr. Skelton talked to you about the bumps in the track, where the track dips up and down. And the residential houses, there's some houses which are level with the site or even lower than the site, and there's some that are higher. So there's a lot of variability in that. That's material to how noise propagates from the site. In terms of the area, the other thing I'd like to highlight is just in terms of sort of the existing environment, what's going on. So there's obviously the North Island Main Trunk is sitting there, existing, and Railway Road running alongside. And when I went to the community meeting, so I attended both of the meetings at Bunnythorpe, I was relatively popular with people who were interested in noise effects. So I've spoke to probably most of the residents closest to the site, so not all of them have submitted. I haven't spoken to everyone, I'm sure, but of those close, most of them came to speak to me. And they all talked about the noise impact from the existing North Island Main Trunk and Railway Road for those nearest houses at least. So for some people, that's a significant part of the existing environment. The other thing a lot of people spoke about was the foodstuffs operation down at the south of the site. So there's the established foodstuffs distribution centre. And I think the impression I got from residents is that had been quite a change in the environment to them. So it's within the northeast industrial zone, and but there were some of the noise characteristics associated with that site that clearly people were noticing that hadn't been there previously. And also the earthworks for the large progressive site. Sorry, I'm not sure which side of the road it is. The warehouse is there now. I had a lot of comments about the reversing beepers on the construction traffic for that site, which I find very irksome, as it's completely avoidable. But so people were aware of those changes sort of happening associated with the northeast industrial zone. Other comments I got about the existing environment, sort of people, quite a lot of people mentioned hearing Manfield at times. That's sort of about motorsport, was about 10 kilometres away. And the reason I mention that and all of these things is not, I'm not about to say, oh, therefore the freight up noise doesn't make any difference. It does. It's more in terms of how people are perceiving their environment. And something like Manfield, the sound levels that people will be hearing will be low. And so it's not a question of just hitting a particular decibel value. It's about the character of the noise and the association of what that noise is as to how it's received. Moving on to this specific proposal. So just to be clear, I've been talking a lot about noise that is in the environment. There are some of the houses that are further from the existing transport infrastructure where it's relatively sort of typical rural environment where you have quiet periods without lots of man-made sources. So it varies a lot throughout the area. So when through the MCA process, when Kiwi Rail were deciding on a site, I raised concerns with this particular site because there are a lot of residential receivers nearby. So I, in that process, I put that on the table as an issue for this particular option. As Kiwira worked through that process and this was emerging as the preferred option, they engaged me to look in a lot more detail to see whether it was a fatal flaw or whether it's something that could be managed. So at that stage, with my colleague, constructed a noise model looking at the general extent of operational noise emissions. So through the early stage of the MCA, I just looked at certain distances. That's based on experience with other comparable sites as to how far noise will typically propagate from such sites.
I'm quite interested in this model idea in such a complex site with so many potential sources. And I think it's probably useful if I ask questions as we go along.
I think so, yes.
So we're all limited by our experience. In my case, it's not an acoustic experience, but I've had experience with acoustic issues. So, for example, with wind farms, point source, you've got particular energy defined by the specification of the emission source that is assessed according to an ISO standard. And that is then propagated through an accepted software model, taking into account complex terrain to identify the potential shadow, noise shadow that might be created. My interest here is I'm not certain that the parameters or the sources have been clearly defined, and I'm not sure that the actual model has been calibrated according to an accepted some models you can assess their calibration, how much they actually reflect reality by seeing how they fire. So, can you tell us more about how you model the those sources and its impacts on the environment? Because I'm quite intrigued about that.
Yes, absolutely. So, the purpose of the modelling in this instance is different to the wind farms. So, for the wind farms, the wind farms are, in terms of the source, it's a relatively easy source to model because it's fixed, and the noise generation for a given wind condition is predictable. With wind farms, the propagation distances are quite large, and so the uncertainties associated with the model are greater at further distances than they are at short distances. But the overall, the turbines don't move around the hill day to day, so you know where they are, and for a wind condition, you can know what they're doing. For the wind farms, you use the model as the demonstration of compliance in that case. For this particular site, we can't use the model in the same way because we don't know for sure the sound power levels, the source levels of all the sources, and there's sources that there are a large number of sources, and I don't have all of them in the model at this stage. And we don't know exactly, we know where the broad elements of the site have to go because they're constrained by rail geometry and so forth, but we don't know the detail about particular items of equipment. So the purpose of the model at this stage, of the noise model at this stage, is to look at an envelope of effects. And so what I've done is I've taken quite a conservative approach. It's not an absolute worst case, but it's what I consider to be realistic, where I put more trains than would certainly be operating at day one, and that I think is reasonably representative of a future scenario. And I've used that to look at the extent of the effects. When the detailed design happens, they'll need to be further assessment once all those source details are known and once the geometry of everything, location of everything is known. And it will be more like a wind farm noise model that you're familiar with, where there's more certainty, but it will still, for a big industrial site like this, it doesn't have that same precision of the exact location. In this case, the ultimate requirement is the noise level received at the house. And the model is showing us where we need to pay attention, but it is not giving us the verification at the house.
So do we use these predictions as helpful tools to assess the effects of light, or do we use them in some ways to define the operating balances for the site? Or are they guided?
So in terms of I've used them as a tool to show what the effects envelope is in broad terms, which then allows us to assess the effects of this proposal as an envelope. As the works are developed, we've set certain bounds on how far to stop the envelope becoming twice as big, but exactly where the effects occur will vary from as indicated by these figures.
Okay, so just on that, is often what I do with statisticians is they do make a prediction, is ask, well, do you stand by that prediction as a means? Is that what you're proposing?
Yes.
So you're effectively saying you can trust me that this is conservative because I'm making it a really good tool.
So potentially I should talk through the process.
Okay.
I'm not dodging the question. I've got answered the question, but I think it'll make more sense if I step through how the concept will be applied.
You know, I'm just trying to voice.
Yeah, no, it's helpful.
Feel my way through this.
So stepping back to the multi-criteria analysis. So there's a point in that process where this was the emerging preferred site. And so because I'd identified noise issues, we went to that stage of the modelling to look at the extent of those issues. From that, we identified relatively high exposures, particularly to the east at the nearest houses. And at that point, I had to look at whether noise barriers were practicable. The reasons I had concerns at this stage in the process, because there is limited space and there's quite, on the Sankster's Road side, there's quite a lot of congestion between the existing North Island main trunk and then the houses. And as I mentioned before, there's quite complex topography there. So if you have a flat site and you can put a straight noise barrier, you can probably make it work fairly easily. So at that point, there was quite a lot of work done between myself and particularly Mike Skelton and Lisa Rimmer on the landscape to make sure that A, from an engineering point of view, and including the stormwater, the noise barriers could actually fit in that gap, and B, you could appropriately treat them such that they don't create a fatal flaw from a visual perspective. So at that point in the process, we worked through those issues, and there were two major changes that occurred to the proposal. One is it was confirmed that the North Island main trunk would have to move. And I understand there's other reasons why that can be beneficial, but for noise, to integrate the noise barrier into the site, that was essential. And the other issue was that the extent of the designation to the north towards Maple Street was extended. So on the plan, there's a block of land going down to the cemetery. And because of this topography, the Maple Street houses are higher. The site's down there, that you can't put a noise barrier on the side of the site because the houses are looking straight over the top. And in order to get an effective noise barrier, we needed to take it back to the Maple Street boundary. Again, there is some variation. There's a big gully towards the cemetery, and so at that point the barrier needs to be quite close to the boundary.
That's going to be quite close to the cemetery, the entire ground.
Yes. Going further to the east, there's a bit more flexibility because there's a higher sort of almost plateau area where the barrier can pull away from the houses a bit. But that they were changes made at that early stage. If I can put it to figure three, please, Jacob, on my evidence. The unmitigated noise contours. So the first figure in the bundle A.
Right, that's the unmitigated without the barriers.
The first one, sorry. That's what. So there's a, on the top of the figure, the east of the site, there's a large red area there that's showing high exposures. There aren't large numbers of houses in that highest exposure, but the exposure is significant. And that's occurring because one of the marshalling yards, the arrival departure tracks, you've got a large open area and then you've got a container terminal. And there's no practicable way of getting noise mitigation closer to the source there, and you end up with higher sources in that area.
So we characterise that as the ribbon of rural residential properties on Sangster's Road, a distribution of lifestyle properties typical of the nodal area style development further south, and then some rural properties. And is that an industrial property in the south?
Sorry, on the south side here. Oh, sorry. Yes, there is a commercial.
It's a commercial building.
Premise, one of those.
So I was moving from north to south.
Yes.
The ribbon area on Sangster's Road, some rural residential patterns typical of nodal development, and then larger rural properties. And
yes.
And there's commercial properties.
And there are still some on Robert's Line. There's still some residential properties.
Yeah.
Probably just outside that, at the red line.
Just as a matter of interest, Ms. Arthur-Young, with the site, were there a number of single large landowners that had a large percentage of the site? And do you have those numbers or figures at some point? Yeah, I'd be quite interested to know at some point. This is a separate question from noise, but it occurred to me. The larger landowners and the percentage that makes up the site. Sorry about that.
No. One thing I'd point out on this figure is I'm showing this blue area out to 45 decibels. For an awful lot of industrial type developments, you wouldn't have predictions out to that extent. The predictions, as I mentioned, for the wind farms, the further you get from the source, there's more uncertainty. And also, a lot of the time, there's not so much effect because the ambient levels will be similar or higher than the noise we're predicting. One of the reasons I've shown that larger contour is just to be transparent about the potential change to the noises, the sounds people might hear in their environment. And it comes back to that point I was making earlier, that it's not necessarily all about noise level. It's the fact acknowledging there's a change. My experience working for particularly some of the roading projects, where the messaging from the proponent of the project through the process has been, we meet the standards, it's all good, but actually for the people experiencing the change, it is a significant change to them.
Sorry, did I understand you to say that if this site had been developed as industry, that there would be still higher levels of impact shown by these blue dots than you would expect? What were the blue dots?
So the point I was making was often for the noise predictions,
yeah,
to predict out to 45 decibels, if you're looking for the, so the daytime noise limits may be 55 or so forth.
Hmm.
So for daytime noise emissions, the 45 isn't relevant in terms of compliance with noise limits. But one of the reasons I'm showing it here is in terms of noise effects on people, is just trying to give a better understanding of the extent over which the noise may be audible.
Mm. No, that's fair. I understand that. In terms of using your LAEQ, I think LAEQ is accepted as an appropriate measurement, but they sometimes use a different time period.
Yes.
Do you and Mr. Lloyd agree on that appropriateness of the 1H?
As I understand it, yes. And I've got in my report, originally I proposed to use an LDN, which is the... So there isn't a New Zealand standard for railways.
No,
I'm interested. So when I started my assessment, I looked at the different options, and the 1-hour LEQ has been used for railways in the likes of the district plan for land use controls.
Yeah.
And I have used it for railways in other circumstances, but it is not a standard. I was looking at this akin to a port or an airport, and they both use LDN, and I was veering towards using the LDN. I spoke to Mr. Lloyd at that stage, and he said, well, for consistency with the district plan land use controls, I'd suggest LEQ 1-hour. So at that point, I moved to LEQ 1-hour. In terms of managing effects, either could work. It's a matter of framing the rules appropriately, depending on which one you use.
What would be the differences from a perceptual point of view with using LDN as opposed to LAEQ?
I find that people struggle with LDN. So LDN is a 24-hour average with the night noise penalised by 10 decibels. Health effects are studied in terms of long-term averages, but people perceiving noise don't relate to a long-term average. So if you were disturbed just now, but on average you were okay. So actually I feel that a 1-hour LEQ is more closely relating to how people are perceiving the noise.
Right. So you feel that from a perceptual point of view, this is the most authentic scale.
Yes. There's no perfect answer. I think this one is appropriate, or the most appropriate.
No, we won't dig down into the physics of that, but and the, how it relates to people's experience, but I understand what you're saying.
Thank you. Okay, so if I move to the next figure.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just the figure with the barriers. So this has now got the site, as I think you will have been told, is all modelled at a level, so 50 metres relative level. This now includes a barrier along the east, so it's something like a 3-kilometre long barrier, which is at the top of it, is at relative level 55, so it's 5 metres above the height of the site.
Mm-hmm.
The height above the local ground level varies, because the local ground level is varying. And that you can see those variations because the contour expands or contracts. That's partly where the sources are located on the site, and it's partly because the ground level is varying.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned in evidence that there's, in my opinion, there's during the detailed design, there's scope to increase the height of the barrier, where there's some houses on elevated grounds in the central section, but that's a matter of detailed design. So the barrier, it's got rid of the highest exposures. There's still a large footprint, and what's happening is that the barrier works best when the sound is forced to deviate from its straight line path. And so for the houses close to the barrier, the sound has to deviate up over the barrier and back down. Whereas the house is 1 kilometre away, the sound is passing over the barrier at a fairly shallow angle, so the barrier is less effective. So the barrier is working hardest for the houses closest to the site. Potentially, there's a kind of an argument here that you throw up your hands and say, well, the barrier doesn't bring the footprint in, so why bother? But the houses nearest to the site benefit.
Yeah.
And they benefit most... from screening of the nearest sources to the houses, because the sound from the nearest sources So the North Island main trunk is the nearest source to the barrier, and the sound from that has to pass, take a longer deviation up over the barrier than the sound from the container handling, which is 200 metres away from the barrier or so forth. To the north of the site, I've mentioned the Maple Street houses. So at this point, as I say, the local ground is moving all over the place. Generally, it's around 5 metres higher than the site. And I've modelled a 3 metre high bund on top of that local ground. So the top of the bund is 8 metres above the site. At 3 metres above the local ground level.
Looks to me like the benefits there are quite modest, but mainly those properties at the end of Maple Street.
Maybe we should... Have we got the zoomed-in version of that? There we go, that's the one. The next page. So this was in the section... The first section 92 response. So these houses in Maple Street, we're sitting at a sort of a critical juncture in terms of the noise exposure, and the barrier is reasonably effective there at getting them all below. So at least daytime operations are within reasonable levels, and then nighttime will be further to more refined modelling. There's an issue I've acknowledged in my evidence. There's at least one house along that strip on Maple Street that's two stories, which the top story would overlook the barrier.
Yeah.
And so that top story may still require treatment. Going to the west, or the bottom of the picture, the ground level after the cemetery sort of drops away as you get to the...
Yes.
Can we go back to the main site? There's a... Where it goes, the barrier... There's a pinch point past the cemetery where it may have to be a wall or a fence rather than a bund, depending on how the detailed design works out. And then it goes down, so it's sort of about 3 metres above the site, down in that northwest corner.
So when you look at page H, 3H, site number 51, I've been told off a few times. When you look at the map bundle, section 3, plate H, site 51, are we seeing some...
I think we're on section 4. Is this one on the screen, sir? Is it? Yes.
Tab 4 plan, actually. Yeah. Is that 51 is not within the designation area, is it? Or
just to clarify there, I've got a couple of things. So we're talking about this one.
Right, yes, that's right.
Correct. That's not in the designation area.
And yet it has a bund through it, is that?
It has a... So at that point, the... barrier would have transitioned into a wall or a fence.
So that's something that's to be negotiated or something, is that how it's...
So for noise mitigation, a barrier is required in that location. So the new perimeter road is passing between the site and that indicative barrier, and the barrier is needed both to mitigate road traffic noise and noise from the site. So the in terms of the barriers within the or on the edge of the designated land, so that there's not a negotiation needed from that.
So this diagram doesn't correctly delineate the designation extent, is that right? Yeah.
So potentially the time sequence of the noise modelling and the refinement of the designation has got an inconsistency there.
Oh, okay. So can you just clarify for that? It's probably a good time to have lunch, start lunch now, but have a think about that, because I don't want to start asking silly questions when my lines are not the correct lines. And
absolutely.
All right. Well, that might be a convenient time to take lunch. Thank you.